Welcome to today's program titled, Enforcing Non-Compete Provisions in Franchise Agreements. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be considered as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this down. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to John Skelton. You may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon. This is John Skelton. I am the co-chair of the Distribution and Franchise Litigation and Counseling Group here at Seyfarth. And welcome to this afternoon's webinar about enforcing non-compete agreements in franchise agreements. My co-presenters today are Eric Wybus and Annie Dunn. Both Eric and Annie are members of the Distribution and Franchise Litigation and Counseling Group, and also they are members of the Trade Secrets, Computer Fraud, and Non-Compete Group. Today's webinar about non-competes, we thought it was pretty important because they're also very important in the franchise context. They're a hotly contested issue. They're in virtually all of the franchise agreements that are out there. And franchisees, by definition, are given access to confidential information, trade secrets, and other proprietary information which franchisors obviously want to protect. In the franchise context, the franchisor's brand is obviously in the hands of the franchisees who serve as the face of the brand to the consuming public. And clearly, franchisors want to be able to protect the integrity of their network and as well as protecting other franchisees. Because, in our experience, most, if not all, franchise agreements contain some sort of restrictive covenant, whether it's an in-term non-compete or a post-term non-compete, there is a potential enforcement issue at virtually every time a franchise agreement is going to be renewed or it's going to be terminated. I'm going to turn it over to Annie, who's going to review for you what we intend to cover. And as noted at the beginning, please, if you have questions throughout, send them in. We have tried to reserve some time at the end, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to address those questions. Annie?
Hello. Today we're going to be covering five separate issues. Eric is going to begin the webinar with a discussion of non-compete basics. John will then be discussing what constitutes a protectable, legitimate business interest and the issue of franchisor goodwill and what it protects. Eric will then cover the permissible scope of time, geographic, and competition restrictions, and John and I will cover some state-specific nuances and other important issues.
Thank you, Annie. As Annie mentioned, this is Eric Wybust speaking. Non-competes arise in several, numerous contexts, in fact, and that context, as well as the relative bargaining position of the parties to the agreements, are key, and they'll play a large, in fact, an oversized role in whether the provision is, in fact, enforced. You'll most often see these, and they're most often litigated, in the employment context. Oftentimes, An employee at the outset of his or her employment or during the term of his or her employment will be asked to sign a restrictive covenant, whether it's a non-compete agreement, non-solicitation of customers, non-solicitation of employees, or a confidentiality agreement. Even within the employment context, the bargaining power of the parties is going to come into play, in particular at the preliminary injunctive stage, which we'll talk about in the next slide. For instance, if you have a rank-and-file employee who just graduated from college and it's their first job and they're 22 years old and they're in a relatively low-level position, they're not given access to the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, then it's less likely you're going to enforce an actual non-compete provision against them, meaning that if they were to leave your employ, that they couldn't go and work for a competitor. You're more likely to be able to enforce a non-solicitation or confidentiality provision. On the other hand, if you're dealing with the CEO of a company or a senior executive or even a mid-level employee who's given access to highly proprietary and confidential information, then the balance swings the other way, and you may be able to enforce a non-compete provision and as well as other restrictive covenants. The other end of the spectrum is in the sale of the business context. And what we mean there is that when somebody is selling their company, and somebody's therefore purchasing that company, oftentimes the seller will include and the buyer will require a non-compete provision. This is the basic reason for it is if you're buying somebody's company, you don't want them to go up and open the exact same company and just continue on under a different name, and therefore what you paid for, you're getting very little value for. Because of that, because usually the buyer and seller of companies are sophisticated, because the consideration for that non-compete is usually specifically negotiated as part of the deal, you're far more likely to enforce a non-compete provision in that context, and it's more likely that a broader non-compete will be enforced in that context than in an employment context, and in particular, a low-level employee context. As far as franchise agreements go, those fall somewhere in the middle, in between the employment context and the sale of the business context. Although most courts and most decisions we've seen will consider it to be more like the sale of a business than it will an employee employment context. Again, you're going to have the balancing factors of how sophisticated is the franchisee. Is this their only store, or do they own 30 franchises of that particular franchisee? Are they given access to confidential information? In fact, one very well-known case in Massachusetts deals with this pretty extensively. It's the Boulanger versus Dunkin' Donuts case from 2004, and they go through an analysis in that case and come to the conclusion that in that case, they were going to treat the franchise non-compete like the sale of a business non-compete. And of course, there were factors in that case that lended itself to that, including that they go through some of them, that the franchise agreement itself specified that the plaintiff as a franchisee was an independent contractor. The plaintiff had to pay to obtain his franchise. He entered into an agreement with his eyes wide open. He was given the benefits of the protections of the franchise system while he was a franchisee. So therefore, after he left, he couldn't go and harm that franchise system. And John will talk in a bit about the franchise system as a protectable interest as it relates to these agreements. And at the end of the day, they said that all of these facts support our conclusion that the franchise agreement was akin to the sale of a business. And then they went on to say that, again, the franchisee was not treated unfairly. So that's just one example. Again, it's going to be a balancing test between the factors. There may be another court on a different day, in a different state perhaps, where the law is different, where they would have come out a different way. But as we said, most courts have come out that the franchise context is more akin to the sale of the business context. In the franchise, as kind of an aside, in the franchise context, the form of that agreement and the implementation of it is very important, because the franchise disclosure document, which is a document, as many of you know, that's mandated by the FTC, similar to a stock prospectus, whenever you're selling a franchise, it's something that the franchisor has to send out a couple weeks in advance of the franchise agreement being signed. And there's 23 items in that disclosure document, and number 17 relates to the renewal, termination, transfer, and dispute resolution. And in that 17, one of the things that you have to disclose is whether there's any interim or post-term covenants not to compete, and you've got to disclose what the terms of that are. So it's very important in this context that you are disclosing that and that you're being careful and reasonable with the terms of it. Which kind of leads into the next topic on this page, which is that the requirements, regardless of the context in which you find yourself, there are certain threshold requirements that have to be met. And we're going to deal with these in more detail in the coming slides. But in summary, they have to be supported by adequate consideration, they have to protect a legitimate business interest, and they have to be reasonable in scope. And again, we'll talk about what those different things mean throughout this presentation. So I mentioned earlier that this is particularly important in the preliminary injunction stage and the equitable remedy stage. Most of these cases, regardless of the context, whether it's the franchise or the employment context, are won or lost at the preliminary injunction stage. And that's where you're going in, as most of you know, and are asking the court to stop the franchisee from continuing to operate either using your trademark or to compete with you, to compete with your other franchisees. And if you're to win that as a franchisor, if you're to win a preliminary injunction, then oftentimes the case will settle thereafter because the franchisee will be required to leave the franchise or to turn over the trademarks or whatever the case may be. And then you can come to some sort of monetary settlement if there is one, or perhaps the only remedy you were seeking was to shut this person down and you can resolve the issue pretty quickly. And again, if you win the preliminary injunction, you're going to have great bargaining power for a settlement and early resolution. If you lose it, then the franchisee is going to have that bargaining power. And often these cases, again, regardless of the context, do settle pretty quickly after the preliminary injunction stage. Few of them, although there are certainly some that go on and kind of pursue a damages claim after that. An important thing to remember is that you don't, although you'll often win or lose the case in the grand scheme of things at the preliminary injunction stage, of course the case still goes on. So even if you lose, you can still, as a franchisor, you can still pursue your case, you could still win at trial, and that's a risk for the franchisee who doesn't leave even though there no preliminary injunction was entered that required them to. And that's because any damages that they're causing by violating their agreement, if they're found at trial to have violated the agreement, will compound during the year or 2 years or 6 months or however long it takes to get to a judgment. So that's something to keep in mind as a franchisee. Now, of course, this is an extremely fact-intensive inquiry that the court's going to undertake. And not only are they looking at the facts and the law, but they're making an equity or a fairness determination. And that is an interesting dynamic because it can change from judge to judge, the same judge on different days, the state you're in, the industry you're in, how good the lawyers are on either side. So it's very important that you're well represented and that you have your ducks in a row and that your agreement is enforceable at the time. And again, we'll get into that in a bit. Now, in order to prevail on a preliminary injunction, you've got to show that you're likely to succeed on the merits of your claim, which means if it's a breach of contract claim, you're going to be able to show that they, in fact, breached the contract, that you're going to suffer immediate irreparable harm if the injunction is not granted, that the balance of the harms is going to favor you as opposed to the franchisee, that not entering an injunction is going to harm you more than entering the injunction will harm the franchisee, and that it's consonant with the public interest. And for that last prong, most courts, although not all, but most will hold that the enforcement of a negotiated contract is consonant with the public interest. And of course, there's states that we'll talk about later that will not enforce non-competes because it's against public policy, but those are few and far between. The one point on these requirements of a preliminary injunction that we did want to spend a minute or two on is the irreparable harm. Some courts will automatically assume that if you can show a likelihood of the success on the merits of your breach of contract claim or whatever the case may be, that you'll necessarily suffer irreparable harm. But that's certainly not the case in every jurisdiction and with every judge. It's not automatic. There's a good example identified here on the slide, which is a 7-Eleven versus Gruel case from last year, the United States District Court for the District of Massachusetts. And in that case, the court found that 7-Eleven had established all of the elements of its claims, that it was likely to succeed on the merits, that it met every requirement of a preliminary injunction except for irreparable harm. And in so doing, they held, and I'm just going to read a few brief quotes from the opinion because it's important. This is a very important issue when you're trying to get a preliminary injunction. It says, therefore, though the court acknowledges 7-Eleven's restrictive covenant will probably be deemed enforceable, it's not clear that delaying the enforcement of this covenant will cause 7-Eleven irreparable harm. It goes on to say, specifically, when the value of 1 or even 2 years of lost profits from one of 7-Eleven's 50,000 worldwide franchise establishments is viewed in proportion to the company's total annual profits, the losses would likely be minuscule. Additionally, denying this portion of 7-Eleven's preliminary injunction certainly would not cause it to lose its indisputably competitive position in the market. It goes on to list some other reasons it didn't find that there'd be immediate irreparable harm. And again, we don't necessarily agree with this decision, that there wouldn't be irreparable harm there, and other courts, even other judges in the same court, may have come out differently on this. And the final point on this is that when you're dealing with a franchisee or an employee who's continuing to use your trademark or there's evidence that they've taken trade secrets or confidential information, you're far more likely to be able to show irreparable harm than just the fact that they're opening a competing shop down the street or in the next town.
So now we're going to, this is John Skelton. So now we're going to switch to the issue of a legitimate business interest and how do you go about proving it and what does that really mean? As Eric mentioned, that's a fundamental aspect or fundamental element of the non-compete agreements. Most commonly, it is a trade secret, use of a trade secret, confidential information, or franchisor goodwill. The Boulanger case that Eric mentioned goes about that, talks about that specifically, and there the court made a distinction between simply trying to prevent ordinary competition versus protecting the franchisor's trade secrets, confidential information, or goodwill. So if all that is at stake is trying to prevent somebody from simply competing with you, that may not be, and in Massachusetts, it is not, a legitimate business interest. We'll talk a little bit later on how the integrity of the franchise system itself may be, in some jurisdictions, a legitimate business interest. Virtually every enforcement issue is going to focus on whether or not there is a legitimate business interest. As I mentioned, trade secrets and confidential information are the bedrock. We're not going to go through, I think everybody kind of knows what constitutes a trade secret. There's got to be something economically valuable to it. There's a six-prong test out there as to what you have to establish in order to show that something does in fact constitute a trade secret. Confidential information is very common in the franchise context, and that is proprietary information that the franchisor treats as confidential when they're sharing it with their franchisee. An important element here is that the franchisor really needs to prove that it is actually treated as confidential in practice, and I'll touch upon that in a moment. The common examples of trade secrets and confidential information are listed here. Business and marketing strategies, customer data and lists, recipes or formulas, site selection criteria, or what the franchisor is going to be doing. There is all of those kinds of things have been recognized as confidential information. And if that kind of information is being shared with the franchisee, and it is shared in a manner in which that confidential nature is protected so that the distribution of that information is limited, then that will go a long way to proving that confidential information is at stake, especially if in the competing post-termination, the franchisee is using that confidential information. The other component that can constitute a protectable business interest is franchisor goodwill. That is very broad. And for litigators, it provides an opportunity to be creative in terms of what actually constitutes a protectable interest and as part of the franchisor's goodwill. In the franchise context, I like to focus on basically two elements, location and reputation. As we know, and as Eric's going to talk about in a minute in terms of the non-compete agreements, we always have them phrased or defined in terms of a time, you can't compete, and a geography. So location necessarily is an important element, and you should be thinking about why is this location where this franchisee is now operating, why is that important to the franchisor? Reputation, it's the brand, it's the customers, it's the customer loyalty that becomes critical. On that, I think that there is always an issue about who are the customers affiliated with. Is it the brand and that they're looking to the brand for the product and service loyalty, or is it the local operator? Are they going to that person solely because of who they are? That may then define whether or not there's goodwill at stake. Obviously, there is an intangible nature to goodwill, and again, I like to think about that being related to the brand name, the reputation, and if there's some aspect of customer confusion associated with that. One issue that I think, so that when if you get to the end of a term of a franchise agreement or the franchisee is terminated and that franchisee continues to operate using the franchisor's trademark, that's a pretty easy case. And in virtually all circumstances, a court is not going to allow the franchisee to continue to use without authority the trademark. The more difficult issue arises, what happens when the franchisee has been a particular franchisee for 10 years, the term of the franchise agreement is now up, and the franchisee decides, I want to continue to operate, but I'm just going to debrand and call my operation, whether it's a coffee shop or some other operation, I'm going to come up with a new name, a new logo, a new trademark, and I'm going to debrand, but I'm going to compete. A couple cases that you may want to take a look at is that the Golden Crust Patties case in New York and the Badass Coffee case out in Utah. Two relatively recent cases. I think they're very informative of what happens when a franchisee debrands. In the Golden Crust case, in both of these cases, the franchisee stopped using the trademarks. But in Golden Crust, they were clearly still trying to trade off of the franchisor's goodwill, because even after removing all the trademarks and the trade dress, they sought to exploit the fact that they were a former franchisee, and the court noted that they, quote, brazenly sought to exploit plaintiff's goodwill by displaying signs that declared, quote, come on in, we're open, nothing has changed, only our name, open, same great food, same great service, thanks for your support. So that was good evidence that the franchisor was able to present to say they are still trading off of, even though they're not using our name and marks, they're still trading off of our goodwill. The Badass Coffee case, I would recommend to just about anyone who's interested in looking at this area, because it provides a very comprehensive analysis of about a lot of the issues in the including preliminary injunction standards. In that case, there was a complete debranding of the they went from Badass Coffee to I think it was Java Cove was the name of the new operations, new trademarks, new name, a little bit of new menu. They were still operating at the same location, and that was important because there was testimony offered where half of the customers were within came from within 2 miles of the location. So the franchisor was be able to show that operating from that specific site was very important. And what the court also noted was they may have changed the name, but they were selling the exact same products. They were selling the same teas and coffees. They sourced them from the same supplier. Many of the names of the drinks were still the same, so that it didn't take a lot for the court to say this was a competing business that was harming the franchisor. So there's a couple other cases. So, you know, what happens if what about protecting the network itself? And that was an issue in the Badass Coffee case, as well as some others, where the franchisor said, well, listen, if you let one franchisee violate this non-compete, everybody else in the network will be emboldened and will leave. And in Badass, the court recognized that as a legitimate business interest and credited the testimony that if the non-compete clauses at issue are not upheld in this case, it would be reasonable to think that other franchisees might be emboldened to follow in the former franchisee's footsteps. There are two other cases that are cited, the Acceleration Products case and the Metro PCS case, which are both similar. In the Metro PCS case, the restrictive covenant was for 6 months and 2 miles, and as the title of the case says, it was a cellular service provider, and the court recognized there that they were particularly vulnerable if it wasn't enforced, that the franchisee would be able to capture their customers before they had an opportunity to reestablish a replacement dealer. So all of these cases, I think, reflect instances where franchisors can point to the sanctity of the network itself, protecting the other franchisees in the system, as a legitimate business interest that would support a non-compete agreement. Finally, it is important to recognize that you have to actually establish that there is a legitimate business interest at stake. If you're looking for the preliminary injunction, franchisor is going to have the burden of proof, has to show a protectable interest, and if you're relying upon trade secrets, confidential information, or goodwill, you can't just rely upon the fact that the agreement says that that's a protectable interest. You need to actually, for example, if it's a trade secret or confidential information, show how it constitutes a trade secret or confidential information, show how it is actually deemed confidential and treated as confidential, and in the case of goodwill, showing that either locational or reputational harm will be important. And that was, I think, reflective in both the Badass Coffee case and the Metro PCS case. So I'm going to turn it back to Eric now, and he's going to talk about the agreements themselves and the time, geographic, and other restrictions.
Thanks, John. What we're going to talk about next is, first, Annie's actually going to talk about interim versus post-term restrictions and what the difference is and what's permitted in each. Then I'm going to talk about temporal and geographic restrictions, the scope of prescribed activities or what competitive restrictions you can place on a franchisee, and then the difference between blue pencil, red pencil, and reformation states. And that has to do with the judge's ability at the preliminary injunction stage to take an overbroad restrictive covenant and make it more reasonable and therefore enforceable.
For those of you that are joining us for CLE credit today, I'm now going to read the CLE code. The code is SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 8043. Again, the code is SS8043. Thank you. In terms of restrictions, there can be both interim and post-term restrictions contained within an agreement. Interim restrictions are more of an issue of loyalty, and they exist during the term of the franchise agreement. These restrictions can be far more restrictive than those contained in a post-term restriction. Specific states have different views on interim versus post-term restrictions. For example, in Illinois, an interim restriction has no geographic limitation. However, a post-term restriction is limited to 20 miles. In Minnesota, participating in, owning, or operating a competing franchise is strictly prohibited in an interim by an interim restriction. Similarly, in Oklahoma, during an interim restriction, a franchisee is prohibited from engaging in any competitive franchise. That being said, there are certain states that do not allow interim restrictions. Specifically, California does not allow for interim restrictions, and certain industries, such as auto dealers, are exempted from interim restrictions. Post-term restrictions are generally less restrictive than those contained in the interim restrictions. These would arise after the termination or non-renewal of a franchise relationship, and as I said before, generally cannot be as restrictive as interim restrictions. They must be reasonably limited in time and geographic scope. There are two cases that are very recent and important in this area. In 2014, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania ruled in the AMCO Transmissions v. Romano case that where a former franchisee attempted to operate a new car servicing center in close proximity to another AMCO facility approximately 1.5 miles away, that they had violated their post-term non-compete restrictions. It should be noted that in this case, the new facility was located 100 miles from their old premises, but as I said before, was within 1.5 miles of another AMCO, which is why the court held they could not operate the new facility. Similarly, in 2014, the U.S. District Court for the Western District of North Carolina held in the Meineke Car Center v. ASAR Inc. case that a post-term non-compete was upheld as reasonable where it was limited in scope. In this case, the post-term restriction was limited to 1 year and within 6 miles of any other Meineke and the franchisee's former Meineke location.
Thank you, Annie. So with respect to, regardless of the context of interim versus post-term, although we'll primarily be talking about post-term restrictions, it's got to be reasonable in time and geographic scope. The basic standard is that it cannot be more restrictive than necessary to protect a legitimate business interest. And of course, John just talked about what those legitimate business interests are. And as we also noticed previously, it's an extremely fact-intensive inquiry. It can vary from state to state, judge to judge, case to case, and the judges will also take into account the equities or the fairness of the situation and the bargaining power and whatnot. Oftentimes, courts will use a balancing test, which is to say that they'll take the geographic restriction and the time restriction, and if they balance each other out, you know, some courts will undertake that sort of analysis. And another interesting issue is in the franchise context, because franchisors necessarily, obviously, have more than one franchisee, there's a distinction between whether you can prohibit a former franchisee from competing within a certain number of miles from where they actually operated or from a franchise that they owned versus any other franchise in the system. Obviously, the latter is much broader, particularly if you're dealing with a nationwide or even a worldwide franchise system, where it effectively would put the person out of would not permit them to work anywhere in the country or in the world. And again, the court's going to consider that. They are going to enforce those in certain circumstances. In other circumstances, they're not. It's going to have to come down to what the argument is about what the protected interest is. And the number of franchisees and the number of locations and whether it is actually a worldwide non-compete. One case in which this came up was the Boulanger versus Dunkin' Donuts case that we've talked about several times now. And in that case, the restriction was on the franchisee was they couldn't operate a competing store for 2 years within 5 miles of any other Dunkin' Donuts franchise. And their argument for that was that they needed to protect the franchise system, which John mentioned was a protectable interest in many circumstances. And the court held that the 2 years was certainly reasonable, and they enforced that. I don't even think that was challenged. And the 5 years from any franchise of Dunkin' Donuts as opposed to just that franchisee's location was also upheld because of the integrity of the franchise system. And the court actually held that was reasonable because the franchise system binds all other franchisees and is part of what the defendant sells. The system is part of what the plaintiff as a franchisee purchased and what protected him while he was a franchise owner. And again, that's kind of the heart of what John was talking about with the franchise system as a protectable interest. Again, we can't say this too many times. Doesn't matter how reasonable your restrictions are. It has to protect a legitimate business interest, and if it doesn't, if you can't establish that it does, then it could be the most reasonable restriction in the world, and it's not going to be enforced. So with respect to reasonableness, the other thing that the courts will consider is the scope of the prescribed activities or what the restricted competition is in the agreement. Most non-compete provisions will restrict a franchisee if the franchise agreement is terminated, from operating a so-called competing or substantially similar business or something to that effect. So what does that really mean? It seems like it's a pretty simple analysis until you really dig in and look at it. And this is what the courts, you know, obviously do from day to day in these cases. So we've got an example here of Seyfarth Donuts, obviously not a real company. And this company in this example started out decades ago selling exclusively donuts and coffee. That was their business for years and years. Since that time, they've grown with the market, with customer needs and desires, and now they sell bagels, sandwiches, flatbreads, tea, soda, sometimes Christmas ornaments, K-cups, and so on and so forth. They're much broader than what they started out as selling. So the question is, could a former franchisee be prohibited by Seyfarth Donuts from opening a competing donut and coffee shop within a reasonable distance of his former Seyfarth Donuts shop? The answer to that is probably. You'd have to look at the actual details. Of course, the devils are in the details. But if it was a reasonable time and it was a reasonable distance and it was limited to prohibiting them from operating a coffee and donut shop, then it would presumably be enforceable. What about a bagel shop, though? Or what about a sub shop? Because remember, this Seyfarth Donuts started selling sandwiches and flatbreads and bagels. Or what about just a coffee shop, not coffee and donuts? Again, it's very fact-intensive, very fact-specific, but because that the Seyfarth Donuts was, in fact, selling those products, there's a very good argument that such a provision would be enforceable as well. So what about a convenience store? It may seem kind of like a wacky example, but as we noted, this Seyfarth Donuts now sells soda, tea, Christmas ornaments at Christmas time, K-cups, so on and so forth. So you could argue that they are competing with a convenience store. That's going to be a far bigger stretch than the bagel shop or the sub shop. And that would be unlikely. That would probably be too broad in the court's eyes. But again, it's fact intensive and will depend on the judge you get and the jurisdiction you're in. Another question that comes up in this context is when the franchisee signed the non-compete. So in our example, what if the franchisee has been a franchisee for 30 years, signed the agreement when all the Seyfarth Donuts was selling were donuts and coffee, and now the Seyfarth Donuts is trying to prohibit him from operating a bagel shop or a sub shop. There's something in the employment context. It's a doctrine that's here in Massachusetts and also in other states called the material change doctrine. And that basically says if you're an employee and your employment relationship has materially changed, there's an argument to be made that the non-compete is no longer enforceable. That hasn't been brought up as far as we know in the franchise context, but the same argument would apply, which is that when the franchisee agreed to not to compete after the relationship ended, all he was agreeing to was not to sell donuts and coffee. He wasn't agreeing not to sell subs or bagels or Christmas ornaments or anything of that nature. So the underlying policy would certainly apply. The next issue is blue pencil versus red pencil versus reformation. And these are states that will narrow the scope or deal with the overbroad restrictive covenants in different ways. The first one we'll talk about is blue pencil. And this is actually often confused with reformation, but there is a difference. In fact, some courts will confuse them and they'll refer to something as blue pencil when it's actually a reformation. And blue pencil means that they'll take the restrictive covenant, they'll cross out any overly broad restrictions, and if what remains after crossing that out is still both reasonable and makes sense, then they'll enforce it. So for example, we've got the same Seyfarth Donuts, and you can see the provision on the screen that says that the former franchisee cannot operate a competing donut shop, coffee shop, or convenience store within 5 miles of the location of its former Seyfarth Donuts shop for 1 year following the termination or non-renewal by franchisor or franchisee. A court in a blue pencil state might decide that restricting them from operating a convenience store is overbroad, and that if the franchisor terminates without cause, perhaps that's overbroad. So they would cross that out. And in this instance, crossing that out, it would be reasonable and it would still make sense after that, because it would still prohibit them from operating a donut shop or a coffee shop within 5 miles after the termination by the franchisee. So that in a blue pencil state, that would be enforceable. Second example is this one, which is much broader. It says that the franchisee cannot operate a competing donut shop within 500 miles of any Seyfarth Donuts location for 10 years following the termination for any reason. If the court were to cross out or blue pencil the overbroad restrictions in that, you'd see what the effect would likely be. But if you read what's left, it doesn't make much sense. It's actually far broader than what they crossed out, because now it's unlimited. It says the franchisee cannot operate a competing donut shop following the termination or non-renewal of the franchise relationship. And what's implied in there is that it's for any amount of time, for any distance, and for any reason that the termination, the franchise agreement was terminated. So that would not be enforceable in a blue pencil state. Red pencil state is the most restrictive, and that's where the court says, if there's any provision of the non-compete restriction that's overbroad, we're going to cross out the whole restriction. We're not going to rewrite your agreement for you. We're not even going to attempt to. Here's the same example we just looked at. Again, we already decided that the court would find certain things in here would be overbroad. Instead of crossing those out and seeing if it would be enforceable, they're just going to cross out the whole thing. And in this instance, the entire provision is unenforceable. And the example given here is not a great one, because it would make more sense if it would have been enforceable. So if you had a restriction that you could have crossed out something in the blue pencil state and made it enforceable, you're out of luck in a red pencil state, because they won't do that for you. You've got to be very careful in those states. You've got to know what they are, because they're just going to throw out the whole thing and you're going to be out of luck, like we mentioned. The public policy behind this is that the drafter of the agreement shouldn't be permitted to impose greater than necessary restrictions, and the court shouldn't have to rewrite the agreement for the parties. That's not the court's role in these states' view. And A state that dealt with that very recently was the Supreme Court of Nebraska in this unlimited opportunity versus WADA case that was, the decision was issued in April of this year. And in that case, they said that we have found that reformation, they call it, is tantamount to the construction of a private agreement, and that the construction of a private agreement is not within the power of the courts. Again, they're not going to rewrite the agreement for you. And the other public policy that I mentioned, they discuss, and they say severability of non-compete covenants is against public policy because it creates uncertainty in employees' contractual relationships with franchisors, increases the potential for confusion by parties to a contract, and encourages litigation of non-compete clauses in contracts. And finally, a reformation. Massachusetts is an example of a reformation state. They will take an overbroad restriction, and they'll actually rewrite it to make it more restrict, to make it more reasonable and therefore enforceable. Again, this is the very broad example we used earlier, and the court might reform it to something like this. They may change the 500 miles to 5. They may change the location to not any Seyfarth Donuts location, but only the one that the franchisee operated, and they might limit the 10 years to 1 year, and so on and so forth. And again, this provision would have been unenforceable in both a red pencil and a blue pencil state, but it may be enforceable in a reformation state like Massachusetts. And one thing to note is that although the court has the power to reform in reformation states, it doesn't have to do so. And so therefore you should, and we always encourage our clients and we always counsel our clients to write these really as narrowly as possible to protect what you're trying to protect, because you may be in a reformation state and they may decide not to reform, or you may be operating nationwide or in multiple states and one of them may be red state or blue state. And again, you're going to be out of luck in that case.
Thank you, Eric. With respect to blue pencil, red pencil, and reformation states, which Eric just covered, there are actually three red pencil states within the nation, and those are Arkansas, Nebraska, and Virginia. There are also 17 blue pencil states and 19 reformation states. Sorry, 30 reformation states. With respect to these different determinations by the court of how to treat agreements, you do need to be careful about how you are drafting. In a statutory context, there are 9 states that have non-compete statutes that either specifically relate to franchises or that have been applied in the franchise context. These 9 states are California, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Louisiana, and North Dakota. There are also 22 states that have franchise relationship laws. California is a unique state in that they prohibit all forms of non-compete agreements. In California, all forms of covenants not to compete are prohibited by statute. A legitimate business interest in the franchise contract context is insufficient to justify a non-compete unless it is in relation to a trade secret. There is in California a judicially created exception to the statute where trade secrets are involved. California has adopted the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, which provides that a trade secret is valuable information where reasonable efforts have been made to maintain its secrecy. Similar to California being unique, Louisiana is also a unique state. In Louisiana, pursuant to Louisiana Revised Statute Section 23921, Louisiana does not actually require a legitimate business interest in order to enforce a non-compete in the franchise context. The only requirements in Louisiana to enforce a non-compete in a franchise context are that the temporal restriction be limited to 2 years or less following the severance of the franchise relationship, and it must be limited to a defined geographic territory. In Louisiana, the courts have held that a defined geographic territory must specifically name municipalities or parishes or parts thereof to be enforceable. There are additional types of legitimate business interests that can be used in states that are not Louisiana. The investment in franchise in terms of time, resources, responsibility, and or training. With respect to training, courts have held that generally the training must be extraordinary or specialized. For example, in Florida, for non-competes entered into after 1996, it must be specialized training. Similarly, in Georgia, for any franchise agreement that was signed after the 2011 Georgia Code annotated 13.851, and in Montana and Texas, specialized training must be shown. In Montana, there have been several recent decisions holding that the franchisors have a legitimate business interest in protecting training, and that is H&R Block Tax Services, LLC, which is a 2010 case out of the U.S. District Court of Montana, and American National Property and Casualty Company versus Camp, which is a 2011 case out of the United States District Court for the District of Montana. Like the federal courts in Montana, the Supreme Court of Texas held in 1987 in the Hill versus Mobile Auto Trim, Inc. case that protection of a franchisor's specialized training and knowledge is a legitimate business interest which supports the imposition of a non-compete agreement. Similarly, in Colorado, courts have held that there should be protection from competition by executive and management personnel. Another important issue that must be considered when drafting agreements is the enforcement against non-signatories. Spouses or other relatives of the franchisee, including their children and straw men, can be held to a non-compete agreement that they did not sign. In 1984, there was a seminal case, McCart versus H&R Block, where a husband and wife jointly created an H&R Block franchise. After 1 year of operation, the husband transferred the franchise to his wife. Several years later, his wife terminated the franchise, and the husband then opened, in the same location, a new tax preparation business. The court held there that even though the husband was not a signatory to the wife's franchise agreement with H&R Block, they were a joint entity and he could be held to that agreement. Similarly, we earlier discussed the AMCO decision, and in that case, the wife was not a signatory to the franchise agreement, but was held to the provisions of the franchise agreement because the court found that if she were allowed to subvert them, it would be against public policy. Spouses are considered agents in business, an agent in business when the wife is benefiting from the husband's status as a franchisor. That's the exact case that occurred in AMCO. As a practice tip, certain franchisors throughout the nation include a spousal acknowledgement in their franchise agreements. That's something that all franchises should consider adding to their franchise agreements. Finally, the use of a straw man who may not be related to the franchisee legally as a spouse is disfavored by courts. In 2013, the Eastern District of Pennsylvania held that where the son of a franchisee's fiance, who was 22, was used as a straw man to hold a series of competing businesses in his name, that the franchisee and his son had violated the non-compete agreements contained within the franchise agreement.
So another question is, you have a mature network, you have a bunch of franchisees who have been in the system for a while, and now you want to add a post-termination non-compete. Can you do that? Well, the short answer is it depends, and you need to look at your own circumstances. Obviously, you can't change midstream for a particular franchisee, but franchisors update their franchise agreements all the time. Most franchise agreements are going to have a provision that says that, you know, this is for a term of X number of years. You'll get some renewal options, but you have to renew at the then existing terms and conditions. And the real question will be, if you're now adding a post-termination non-compete, how material of a change is that to the relationship? And if it is such a significant and material change to the relationship, does that prevent you from adding and changing that relationship? One of the things you would want to look at there is the language in the franchise agreement itself, and what does it say to the franchisee about future potential changes. Is there going to be some form of additional consideration provided by the franchisor for the non-compete? And you also have to look at the state law, you know, the state law in the particular jurisdiction. As Annie mentioned, there's a number of states that have relationship laws. Many of those relationship laws will provide that you cannot fail to renew a franchise agreement except for good cause, and adding a material change to that relationship may constitute a non-renewal. And there's also anti-discrimination provisions in some state statutes that limit your ability to differentiate between franchisees.
So with that, we've got some time left for questions, and we've gotten some, and I think I'll turn it over to the moderator to tell you how to ask questions, and then we'll have time for just a few. Okay. The first question is, California allows non-competes in the sale of a business, so are non-competes okay in the franchise context in California? And the simple answer to that is no, that Section 16600 applies to any sort of contract, and that would include franchise agreements. And there's actually a case from 1990 in the Northern District of California called Scott versus Snelling and Snelling, which held that the franchisee's use of a franchisor's goodwill is not sufficient to bring the relationship within the statutory exception of 16601, and that's the exception for the sale of the business. There might be a case where this franchisee is selling his franchise to another franchisee, and there could be some sort of, the exception might apply there, but generally speaking, just because a franchise agreement terminates, that's not going to turn into the sale of the business context.
So quickly, one other is, if you have to prove irreparable harm, what does the fact that there is a liquidated damages provision in the franchise agreement, what does that mean? Going back to, and one of the reasons why I said if you read a case, the Badass Coffee case is actually a pretty good one to read. The court addressed the issue of liquidated damages provisions there and noted that not all courts are in agreement as to what happens, but there was no case directly on point, and it recognized that in some instances, the existence of a liquidated damages provision may in fact preclude a finding of irreparable harm. I think what you have to do is you have to focus on the intangible harm. There, it focused on the harm to the franchisor's goodwill and to the strength of the franchise. Presumably, the court was referring back to where it said if this guy gets to leave, others will leave too, and recognized that harm to that goodwill or the strength or reputation is hard to quantify. I think the critical issue is going to be, what does the liquidated damage provision in the franchise agreement address, and what does it try to quantify?
And with that, we are out of time, but we thank you very much for coming and spending your lunch break with us and listening to our webinar. If you want to stay current on these issues, we encourage you to check out our Trade Secrets blog. The website is on the screen, and we'd invite you to join our upcoming franchise and distribution webinar on December 10th called Bumper to Bumper Coverage, Highlighting Significant Motor Vehicle Franchise Decisions from 2015. And With that, there's our contact information. Feel free to reach out to any of us with questions or just to say hello. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you. This concludes today's webinar. You may have a great day.